humor, and particularly ironic humor, is everywhere in this novel. And I had the feeling it's almost as if when we readers are becoming mesmerized by the fantasy tale and the intricacy of the plots, this humor is sort of a snap of the fingers to remind us that you're a contemporary writer with a contemporary sensibility.
Yeah, I mean, I do think of myself as that. I think of myself, I like to be a writer of my time, you know, in my time, and thinking about what is happening in my time and trying to find stories to tell which arise out of that thinking. And so, yes, I mean, however fantasticated this book might be, it is an attempt to talk about the present. It's an attempt to say that this is how we feel about the world we live in. We feel that it's somehow off balance, and we don't fully understand what's going on, and it's bewildering and strange and frightening, and there appear to be monsters on the loose. And I think, you know, a novel says that through metaphor and imagery and sometimes through fairy tale, but it reflects, I think, a real feeling. And I think that's, you know, when people use the term magic realism, they almost always hear only the word magic. Whereas actually what is important about this kind of writing is that it's grounded in realism. You know, that the realism part of magic realism is at least as important as the magic bit.
Well, I have to tell you, with some of the things that have been on the news and the extreme weather in the past couple of weeks as I was reading the book, I thought maybe there are slits between Earth and Peristan, and you know, the genies are wreaking their havoc.
There they are, making trouble. You know, yesterday's fantasy is tomorrow's news headline.
Well, one of the quotes that prefaces the novel is from Italo Calvino. Instead of making myself write the book I ought to write, the novel that was expected of me, I conjured up the book I myself would have liked to read. When we spoke about The Enchantress of Florence, particularly the humor, you said almost that identical phrase, that this, you enjoy writing books you'd want to read.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way it's the best reason for writing books, to write books that you can't find anywhere. And so you may as well write them so that it's there to be read. I mean, as it happens, I was fortunate enough to know Calvino towards the end of his life. And he was a great supporter of my work and a great encourager of me. And so I've always was very grateful for that. And some of, I mean, some, not all of his ideas I find very congenial. Certainly that one, you know, because Calvino started writing in the post-war period in Italy when the vogue was all for neorealism. You know, when there were films like Bicycle Thieves and Rome Open City, and the thing you were supposed to do was to write ultra-realistic fiction and make ultra-realistic films. And he rebelled against that by writing his bizarre fables like The Baron in the Trees. And I think we at the moment live in what one could call a non-fictional moment. You know, I think people seem to have become more interested in non-fiction than in fiction. And even in fiction, they seem to be responding best to a sort of non-fictional kind of fiction, like the writing of Elena Ferrante or Carlo Vignausgaard, you know, these enormous volumes which appear to be drawn more or less directly from the detailed experience of the writer's personal life. And that seems to be where we are right now, you know. And so I thought I'd run in the opposite direction as far as I could.
There are many fascinating characters in this book. Two of my favorites were Blue Yasmin and Sister Cece Albi. Would you talk about them a little bit?
Oh, yes. Well, Mr. Geronimo lives in this this apartment building called the Baghdad, which has no H in it. It's been Americanized.
Yes.
And yes, and Sister Olby is the supervisor of the building, and one of the other tenants is this storyteller called Blue Yasmin, who shows up at I guess a kind of parody version of the moth, you know, which in the novel is called the locust, and she tells amazing stories, and somehow the old supervisor and she, the old supervisor appears to be sort of half in love with her. And their relationship in the building is a kind of counterpoint to Mr. Geronimo floating off the ground in his basement apartment, which the supervisor seriously disapproves of, but she's encouraged to forgive him by Blue Yasmin, who isn't blue and is probably not called Yasmin, but it's her nom de plume.
She's Lebanonymous.
She's Lebanonymous, yes, exactly. I mean, she was one of the characters, you know, one of the great things for me about writing this book was to be able to tell a number of what I hope are enjoyable tales all around the main story, so that the main story is kind of in the middle of a crowd of other stories. Mm-hmm. And she's one of the ones that I was most happy with. And I think, in a way, for me, that's always been a way of trying to represent the nature of life in a big city. Because I think, whether it's Bombay in Midnight's Children or New York in this novel, one of the characteristics of the life of a big city is that we are surrounded by other people's stories. You know, that we are surrounded by a crowd of stories jostling for space, you know, and encountering each other and having arguments or falling in love with each other or stepping over each other in the street. And so for me, a very good way to represent the city, the life of the city in a novel, is to deliberately tell too many stories. to have that crowd of narratives in the book and have your story that you're really trying to tell have to literally elbow its way through the crowd.
Well, for all of the humor, you seriously address the philosophical question of reason versus religion, which has been a recurring theme in your work. What was it like to write about that debate within the context of fantasy?
Oh, well, of course, I mean, the great thing about fantasy as of science fiction is that they have always been forms which have been very naturally inclined towards the novel of ideas, you know, and so it actually comes quite naturally in the language of fantasy to be able to have ideas in discourse with each other. So my two philosophers arguing just fitted right in. And actually, again, something happened which I wasn't expecting, that when I first started thinking about the book, I thought this passage, which is now the first chapter of the book, would just be a kind of prologue in which these two philosophers would argue while one of them fell in love with the fairy princess and spawned vast numbers of children. And I thought after that, we'll just leap 900 years to the present day and we'll have the rest of the novel. But once I started their conversation going, I thought it was so enjoyable that I thought, I don't want to let this go. I've got to find a way of letting them go on having that argument even 900 years later when they've been dead for nine centuries. So I had to find a device to bring them back from the grave so they could go on arguing.
I felt the presence of your friend, the late Christopher Hitchens, in those portions. Am I reading too much into it?
Well, no, I guess not. I mean, I wasn't consciously thinking about Christopher, but Christopher was a wonderful person to argue with, that's for sure. I miss it, yes. Actually, there's a character in the book of there's this character of an English composer called Hugo Casterbridge. And several people now have said to me that they thought that I had based that character on Christopher Hitchens, which, I don't know, maybe I subliminally did, because it's a character of somebody who's highly opinionated and very argumentative and rather irascible. Which, I don't know, maybe Christopher was not so much irascible, but he certainly was argumentative.
I didn't feel the irascible so much, but perhaps his smiling in the background about during these passages about mm-hmm. religion and reason, or religion
well,
versus...
certainly that would have been a thing that we had... I mean, we disagreed about some things, but not about that.
No. Ultimately, the novel is a love letter to storytelling. And I wondered if you set out to write an ode to literature.
Well, I mean, except that it's also an ode to the subject of literature, which is human nature, you know. And I think the beauty of telling stories, if you're privileged enough to be one of the people who get to do it, is that you get to explore this, the greatest and most inexhaustible of subject, which is what we're like, or what are we like, you know, and why are we like it, so yes, it's a love letter to stories, but it's also a love letter to the subjects of stories, which is us.
Well, with its many plot threads and intricacies, it feels like a literary counterpart of an exquisite Persian rug.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very nice.
Well,
yeah. it's an exquisite Persian rug transported to downtown Manhattan.
All good. Yeah. All, and the best of fantasy lands.
Yeah. Yeah.
You are missed in Atlanta by many of us.
Oh, thank you. You know, I mean, I had such a good time in this very long period of time that I was teaching in Atlanta, is 10 years or so. And I mean, I'll be back, you know, because I've made so many friendships all over the place in that long period of time that I certainly have no intention of losing touch with the place. And, you know, all my papers are there, the archives are
yes.
there, that'll continue to be there. And I've been talking to the folks at Emory about having some kind of continued relationship based on the presence of the archive, doing something around the archive, you know, once a year maybe, et cetera. So we're thinking about that.
Well, we look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.